Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, the rise and rise and rise of Live Nation. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
This is another of our episodes marking the 20th anniversary of CMU, looking back at some of the biggest stories that we reported on in those first two decades. And this week we're turning to the live sector, not the whole sector.
Although nearly.
But just one company. But yeah, as you say, nearly all of the live sector, which is, of course, Live Nation.
Yeah, Live Nation. So if you look at the 20 stories that we picked a year ago when CMU celebrated its 20th birthday.
Yes.
In terms of the big companies, we talked about those that collapsed.
We did.
So we've done EMI and HMV.
We've delighted in people's failure, is what you're saying.
But in terms of companies that have grown, I mean, we could have put the focus on any of the major record companies, because all of the major record companies have grown over the last 20 years, mainly through mergers and acquisitions. Because when we launched CMU in 1998, I think there were still 6 major labels, and then it came 5, and then 4, and now 3.
Yeah.
And that was all through the merging. So the major labels kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. They bought other stuff too, but they also bought each other.
Yes.
So we could have talked about Sony.
And they branched out into new things. We could have talked about that.
We could have talked about that. So Sony, Universal, Warner could have been on the list. And on the live side, I mean, many of the booking agencies have also grown. Again, often through mergers and acquisitions. We could have talked about AEG, the other big company on the live side. But I think if there is one company that has just grown, diversified, and become an incredibly dominant player in the 20 years that CMU has existed, it is a company that wasn't even called Live Nation 20 years ago when CMU began. The notion of there being a company with Live and Nation in its name was some way away. But the origins of this massive live music business was already underway by the late 1990s.
Yeah, so as you say, when CMU launched in 1998, the company that would become Live Nation was then known as SFX, the live music business of Robert F.X. Silliman, who would later turn up in our reporting confusingly, via a company also called SFX.
Yeah, anyone who has been reading the CMU Daily in more recent years, or indeed listening to the podcast, might be thinking, hang on a second.
Yeah.
There was a company called SFX that was big news a few years back when the electronic dance music boom occurred in the US.
Yes.
Suddenly the Americans noticed this thing called dance music. I think some people in Detroit would argue that they'd be pretty on it with dance music before the EDM explosion. But this guy called Robert F.X. Silliman, he's had various goes at launching music and media companies over the years. And saying he's had goes makes that sound quite dismissive, doesn't it?
It does, because they've been quite big goes.
The most recent SFX did collapse in quite a spectacular fashion.
Yeah, but it grew in quite a spectacular fashion before that.
It did. It made the...
How it was able to collapse quite so spectacularly.
It made the spectacular collapse all the more spectacular.
I mean, it was basically, he had the same strategy for that company as he did with the original SFX that became Live Nation, of just buy up loads and loads of companies and grow and become the biggest company in live music.
Except
it didn't work second time round.
Well, second time round, it was specifically dance music.
Yes.
Capitalising on a bubble that then burst and the whole thing fell apart. But I mean, between that SFX and the earlier SFX, he had a whole other business in between, which saw him buy up things like the American Idol franchise and 19 Entertainment, the management and talent company here in London, and a whole load of other things. Oh, he bought into the Elvis estate, ran the Elvis estate for a while. And so that was quite a successful business. It then subsequently also had its financial problems, but that was after he'd sold it. So that wasn't his fault.
Okay.
But the original SFX was very much a success story. So it was growing by the late 1990s. And I can remember in the very early days of CMU, we used to share an office with a sort of an event/marketing company. So they were doing stuff in events and concerts and tours and brand marketing. And so they were very honed in on SFX. Initially quiet and then louder acquisition of more and more promoters and venues and live music businesses. It almost became a bit of a running joke as to what has SFX bought this week. I mean, 20 years on, we're still kind of have that running joke. What have Live Nation bought this week? Also, because we also do stuff up at the Edinburgh Festival and always have done, we know quite a lot of people on the theatre side and they were busy buying up lots of theatre venues. In fact, the first time I came across SFX wasn't a music thing. It was when they bought a bunch of theatre venues in the UK. So this company, SFX, was growing, and as you say, the strategist was, if it's up for sale, buy it. So across the live music space, particularly in venues. And so that grew. But then, having bought lots of stuff, it then got bought.
Yes, as is often the case, something grows, becomes a big thing, and then a bigger thing says, I would like that big thing, and I will have it. And the bigger thing in this case was Clear Channel, the radio company in the US, which now itself is not Clear Channel, it's the radio company iHeartMedia. But back then it was Clear Channel, and it bought SFX, and it turned it into the Clear Channel Entertainment Division, which is how it stayed until 2005, when it had got even bigger, and so it was spun off as a standalone business, and that is when it became Live Nation.
Yeah, the Live Nation brand has now arrived. But there was that five-year period where, yeah, you had the Clear Channel radio company, biggest broadcaster, mainly in the US, its media interest, but nevertheless, huge player in radio in America. It also has an advertising business, mainly outdoor advertising.
And the Clear Channel advertising business, that's the bit of Clear Channel that is still Clear Channel.
And occasionally you will see their logo beyond billboards and stuff around cities, etc. And then it had the live side. And I remember the big part of the conversation in the early 2000s was it was already a massive player in radio. Radio was still booming at the time, and then it was expanding its live interests all over the world, actually, but particularly in the US, becoming a massive player in the US. And lots of people started to talk about, well, hang on a second, is now there a conflict of interest that this company has all these radio stations over here and all this live music over here? And some people used to say, well, it's becoming too dominant even back then. Mainly in those days, people were criticizing the dominance, not in that the live music division in itself was too dominant, but that as part of a group that also was the biggest broadcaster in America, maybe this company was getting too dominant in the wider music space. Although it always struck me back in those days that the three different Clear Channel divisions, so the radio bit, the live bit, and the advertising bit, as with any big company, they never seemed to talk to each other.
No.
They were all operated quite autonomously. So I always used to say, if there's any dodgy dealing going on behind the scenes between the radio division, the live division, the advertising division, I can't believe that's actually happening. Because as far as I can see, the people who work for those three different sides of the business don't really understand what each other do and don't talk to each other. And certainly, as you say, in 2005, they became literally two separate businesses when they spun off the Live Entertainment Group. It became its own company listed on New York Stock Exchange, and that was the point at which the Live Nation brand was born.
And once it was its own standalone business, it started to grow its own different divisions. So it had its venues, it had its promoters, it had its festivals division that got much, much bigger. And for a time, it looked like it was going to get into recordings as well. I mean, it was quite early on after it became Live Nation that it started doing 360-degree deals with big artists. And I don't know if anyone remembers, but all the reporting at the time, and this got into the mainstream news, it was on the BBC News and everything, because they were signing big artists to these big deals where they just took over their entire business. This was going to be the future of being a musician. Everyone would be signed to one of these 360-degree deals.
Yeah, you're right. So just a couple of years, really, after Live Nation had spun off as its own thing, the acquisitions were ongoing, all those different divisions that you mentioned were getting bigger and bigger, and particularly here in the UK, it really started to ramp up its presence here in the UK. But it was interesting, wasn't it? Because let's put this into the wider context of the bigger music industry. So this is, what, 2007, I guess, we're talking about now. So the latter half of the 2000s, at which point the record industry was in disarray. We've talked about this before on the Setlist specials, how the recorded music industry had been going down, 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 down from about 2000 onwards for all the reasons that we've discussed endlessly on Setlist and elsewhere. So the record companies were really starting to panic about the fact that the recorded music revenue stream was still in decline. And even though by this point, the iTunes Music Store was really starting to gain momentum, YouTube was starting to come on board. In America, you had Pandora really starting to gain momentum. But nevertheless, the record industry was still bringing in less money every year than the previous year. And that's when this notion of the 360-degree deal started to be discussed. But initially, it was discussed in the context of the record industry. Because what we started to see was record companies, when they were signing artists, and obviously record companies, when they sign a new artist, put quite a lot of money on the table traditionally. I mean, some labels put a lot of money on the table, some less. But because labels were continuing to invest cash and marketing and everything else into new artists, which traditionally would have been secured just on the sound recording revenue stream, so labels obviously traditionally would take ownership of the sound recording copyrights created under their relationships with their artists and then monetize those recordings, make money out of them, keep most of that money, share a little bit of the artists, but at the same time, say to the artist, but when it comes to your songs and your tours and your merch, you can do whatever you like with that. Because the sound recorded revenue stream was in steep decline still, labels started to say to their artists as they were signing them, we want a cut of something else. We want a cut of your touring or your publishing or your merch or your brand partnerships. And we went through that period in the latter half of the 2000s, whereas initially managers and lawyers for artists were pushing back on that. and saying, we don't want to give you anything else. How is the artist ever going to make any money if we have to give you everything? It then got to the point, in most cases for new talent deals, certainly if you wanted a major label relationship, those were the only deals on the table. And this notion of the 360-degree deal started to be talked about a lot. The fact that labels were getting involved in aspects of their artist's career beyond sound recordings. Obviously, the term 360-degree deal suggests that the label is involved in everything, doesn't it?
Yes.
You can't be 360 without being in everything. But actually, the deals the labels were doing at that time, even the most severe multi-revenue stream deals, or ancillary deals, as the labels often called them, were never 360. It wasn't that it included absolutely everything that the artist was doing. It would just be the label saying, we want to share in a couple of other revenue streams. And which revenue streams would vary depending on which label, which artist, which deal, etc. But this notion of the 360-degree deal was becoming a big talking point within the music industry. In the UK, we had the Sanctuary Group. Do you remember the Sanctuary Group?
I remember.
Which, of course, grew out of Iron Maiden's management company. And it started buying into all different aspects of the music industry. So originally it had been a management company, it already got a label and an agency, and then they expanded the management, and they got into merch, and they started setting up all these different strands, and they were often held up as being the future of the music industry, a 360-degree music company. What would now probably be dubbed a full-stack music company.
Yeah.
Because in the last couple of years, everybody having abandoned the notion of 360-degree deals, we now talk about full-stack music companies. So a music company that does everything. But Sanctuary was being held up as being a brand new model. It then crashed and burned. Given that this is meant to be the one set list where we talk about a success story, we've been bringing up a lot of companies that failed. But everyone was talking about 360-degree deals. And actually, in this era, perversely, given that this conversation began in the record industry, the only company that actually genuinely did something nearly, not quite, but nearly like a 360-degree deal was Live Nation. And so after Live Nation had become its own thing, and as the touring and the festivals and all of that were starting to grow, they decided that they were going to set up a new division, and they were going to sign superstar artists who they were already working with on the live side, and they were going to sign up all of their other revenue streams, and in essence go into competition with the record industry and the music publishers and the merchandisers, etc. And the four artists that they did deals with of this nature, of one form or another, were Madonna, Shakira, Nickelback and Jay-Z.
What a team.
What a roster of artists. And these were incredibly expensive deals. I think that's one of the reasons why it got coverage, not just in the music business press, where everyone had been talking about these 360-degree deals. It got coverage across the music press, but also in the mainstream news press. Because A, they were superstar artists, but also, we were talking multi-million dollar advances as part of these deals. I mean, I think in most cases, tens of millions of dollars advances in these cases.
Well, in Jay-Z's case, his own business as well, which is another success story we could talk about.
Yeah, let's hold that thought and we'll come on to the Jay-Z Nation business.
Yes.
But yeah, so they did these four deals, and those deals basically covered every element of those artists' careers with massive, massive upfront advances. Now, at the time, people were like, whoa, this seems like a bit of a risky plan on Live Nation's part. And in some ways, people were right to be a little bit cynical about how this was going to turn out.
Yeah, well, and one of the reasons that people were cynical about these deals was it wasn't that it was these artists all starting with a clean slate, starting afresh, new business, everything covered, handled by Live Nation. I mean, certainly in the case of Madonna, she was still signed to Warner. Jay-Z was still signed to Universal when he did this deal. Parts of the deal were to be enacted in the future.
I suppose that's the problem. If you're going to try and do a 360-degree deal with an established act rather than a brand new act, I mean, in the main, where the labels were getting a share of other revenue streams, they were generally newer artists who wouldn't have too many of those deals already in place.
Yeah.
But when you're signing a Madonna or a Jay-Z, yeah, they've already got all their deals in place and they're not all going to expire at the same time. There's not going to be 1 month where it's like, okay, every deal that that artist had has suddenly ended. Yeah, so you're right. Madonna, for certain, still had albums to deliver to Warner Music. I think on the Jay-Z side, on the recording side, he actually used some of that advance to buy himself out of his commitments to Universal Music. But then on the publishing side, it wasn't really that Live Nation was signing these artists to publish them. It was that they were getting a cut of the artist's cut on the existing publishing deals. So yeah, the deals were a little bit more complicated once you started digging. Not all elements of the deal were going to kick in straight away. Hence why people were perhaps a little bit cynical about these phenomenal checks that were being written up front. Although, let's go back through that list. Madonna, Jay-Z, Nickelback, Shakira, four of the biggest touring artists in the world. Yeah, even Nickelback Let's not forget just how successful Nickelback were back then when they were on tour. So I'm pretty sure that Live Nation knew that providing these artists didn't die, and spoiler alert, none of them did.
No.
Providing they didn't die, providing they fulfilled the commitments that they were making with regards to touring, because actually that was another unusual element of this deal. Generally, when artists sign up with promoters, they're not long-term commitments, as opposed to a record deal or a publishing deal, where often the artist is locked in to work with that label or publisher for a number of years, sometimes like 10 years. Whereas generally on the live side, artists don't commit to one promoter for that length of time. And they were making big commitments to Live Nation here. So providing these artists were able to continue touring, it was probably pretty assured they'd make those advances back just on the ticketing income down the line. So it wasn't perhaps quite as risky as it first seemed. But you mentioned how Madonna still had albums to deliver to Warner. So it was like a couple of years before she was even in a position to put out a record with Live Nation. And this is why people were right to be cynical about this move. By the time that side of the Madonna deal was starting to kick in, Live Nation had a change of heart. And they no longer wanted to be a record company or involved in intellectual property and music copyright. And they'd kind of abandoned all of that. And the division that had been set up to do these deals had changed quite a bit. And so things like the recordings bit, I seem to remember they outsourced it to Universal.
Yeah.
So having been positioned as this bold new player in the record industry and the music copyright business, in the end, they didn't do any of that. They just outsourced it all and plowed on with the live side. They did go quite big into merchandise, which I suppose kind of makes sense. I mean, Universal Music also went massive on merchandise,
yeah,
mainly by buying Bravado off the aforementioned Sanctuary Music when it crashed and burned. But I suppose, whereas it makes sense for a record company to get involved in merchandise because really merch is just another kind of intellectual property, taking all the visual stuff and turning it into products, it makes sense for a live company to get into merchandise because, well, where do you sell most of this merch?
Yeah.
At the shows. So it makes sense for the live side to be involved. But yeah, when it came to Live Nation's ambitions to be this one-stop shop, 360-degree music company with interests across the music business beyond the live space, it ended up being quite short-lived. They only ever did these four deals. And of the four deals, I mean, you mentioned what happened to the Jay-Z deal. Really, that's the only one that long-term became interesting. Because what Jay-Z did was he took that deal and then he turned it into a joint venture with Live Nation. And out of that grew Roc Nation. And I suppose, interestingly, Roc Nation is the one bit of Live Nation. I mean, it's quite autonomously run.
Yeah.
But still, Live Nation have a significant stake in it. And Roc Nation is the one bit of Live Nation business which actually has carried on doing everything. Because they do still put out records and do some publishing and do management and all of that.
Yeah, so, and well, they've got a sports division as well.
So through Roc Nation, actually, because they did the deal with Jay-Z, Live Nation did get its fingers in all these other pies. But the main Live Nation business kind of backtracked on all of that and put the focus back on the key areas of the business, touring, venues and festivals. And to continue a theme, grew all three of those quite significantly, particularly in the US, here in the UK, but also across Europe and then ultimately the rest of the world. Usually through acquisition, by buying up ever more venues, promoters and festivals to grow that live business. And so live remained the focus, although there was still more diversification to come, again through acquisition a few years later.
Yeah, because the biggest of those acquisitions came in 2010, which was when Live Nation merged with Ticketmaster, obviously the biggest ticket-selling company in the world. That merger made two big companies into a much bigger company, and there was a lot of regulator scrutiny of that deal. In fact, in the UK, the Competition Commission ruled against the merger in 2009 before overturning that decision a few months later. In the US, it was passed through with some conditions, although not massive conditions, although conditions that were 10 years in length, so they're still not quite out of them.
And have been in the news again.
Exactly, yeah, because, well, throughout this 10 years, there have been accusations that they've breached the terms of those conditions, and then those accusations are coming up in the news again now.
But yeah, the merger with Ticketmaster, which really, with hindsight, was a takeover of Ticketmaster, really. It always amused me that...
Although they did rebrand the company.
They did rebrand the company.
It changed from Live Nation to Live Nation Entertainment.
Because Ticketmaster technically was called Ticketmaster Entertainment.
Yeah, so they merged the two names.
And then Ticketmaster became the ticket division of Live Nation. But it was a very interesting acquisition beyond the competition concerns, which obviously companies like AEG, the other big tour promoter, I mean, they did not like that acquisition because they used Ticketmaster to sell their tickets. And now it was going to be, hang on a second, our competitor is going to be selling our tickets. Although, when other ticketing companies like Eventim in Europe kicked up a fuss, and actually they were behind most of the fuss here in the UK, where, as you say, initially the Competition Commission here did raise objections, but Live Nation's argument back almost was, well, clearly as soon as AEG can stop using Ticketmaster, it's gonna, and that's actually a huge opportunity for Ticketmaster's competitors. So therefore, that's a reason why people shouldn't express competition concerns, was what Live Nation was saying at the time. But I think the Ticketmaster acquisition was interesting for two reasons. So let's talk about reason number one.
Okay.
Which is data. Now, we all know how
Everyone loves data. Fan data
is. In fact, it's so important that we, along with the MMF, published that fan data guide earlier this
year. That's just how important it is.
And it has to be pretty damn important to get a guide under the Dissecting Digital Dollar series. So we all know that fan data has become a big talking point over the last, 10, 15 years, and continues to be to this day.
It's sort of more recently people have worked out what to do with the data rather than just gleefully amassing it.
But to be fair to Live Nation, I think that when they bought Ticketmaster, that was them recognising just how valuable ticketing data was in the wider fan data ecosystem. Because the ticketing companies had among the best fan data. And I genuinely believe that Live Nation did recognise that when they instigated this merger. It wasn't that they just wanted to own the website where they were selling their tickets. It was the data that Ticketmaster was sitting on. Because if you think of the music industry pre-digital, so pre-CMU even, back in the 1990s, so before the web was anything more than something that academics and geeks played with, back in the 1990s, the CD heyday on the recorded music side, the truth is that artists didn't really know who their fans were. I always say, beyond the fan letter and the mosh pit, they had no idea who was buying their music. You put records out there, and you put tickets on sale, and you just hope somewhere out there people would buy the record and buy the tickets. Because between the artist and the fan, pre-digital, there had to be business partners. The only way for artists to reach the fan beyond, you know, the, I suppose, that initial fan base in their hometown, who they probably did know face-to-face. But as soon as the fan base started to grow, there was always business partners between the artist and the fan. So on the recording side, there'd be a label. And on the live side, there'd be a promoter. But if we're being honest, the labels didn't really know who the fans were. I mean, okay, in the 90s, some labels, they did start putting those little postcards in CDs, didn't
they?
So you could fill it out and send it off, and then they'd send you a postcard or something. But A, only really the super fans would ever fill out those postcards anyway. And B, the labels never really did anything of any use with that data. And between the label and the fan was a record shop, was a retailer. So the label didn't have a direct fan relationship. So we had the artist, then the label, then the retailer. And then the retailers, okay, on a grassroots level, the people who worked in the shop may understand who's buying what music, but the retailers weren't amassing that data in any great way. Meanwhile, on the live side, the artist didn't know who's coming to the gigs. The promoters didn't know who was coming to the gigs. Who knew who was coming to the gigs? The ticketing companies did, because in the 1990s, ticketing became a telesales business. And so by chance, not because of any clever strategy, by chance, ticketing companies started taking names and addresses and phone numbers of the people buying the tickets. Because you have to do that if you're taking the order on the phone, which is how ticketing became. And then, of course, in the early 2000s, ticketing slowly shifted online and was one of the first bits of the music industry where online really started to become a big thing. So then they started gathering email addresses and all this other data. So by 2010, when Live Nation bought Ticketmaster, Ticketmaster was sitting on the best database of music fans in the world. Now, of course, they only know who bought the ticket. They don't actually know who came to see the show. So it's not perfect. And it's only really now, as mobile ticketing is finally starting to take off, that we'll get to the point where we actually know who came to the show. But nevertheless, Ticketmaster was sitting on way better data than anybody else. And I think that was what Live Nation recognized, that that data was hugely powerful to help them sell their shows, help them get more people into their venues, and help with the ever-evolving festival business. And so they merged with Ticketmaster, as you say, to become Live Nation Entertainment with the Ticketmaster division. So that was reason number one why that deal was interesting.
Okay, number two then.
Number two was that one of the reasons why Ticketmaster had rebranded as Ticketmaster Entertainment is actually pre the Live Nation deal, Ticketmaster had also been diversifying. It was primarily a ticketing company and a data company. But it had also been moving into artist management and had been doing that initially by buying up a company that the sort of the veteran artist manager Irving Azoff had built called Frontline. And he'd been buying up management companies to create something of a management powerhouse. And then Ticketmaster bought that. And then it started buying up more management companies, particularly in the US, but also elsewhere in the world as well. And so when Live Nation bought Ticketmaster, not only did it add ticketing to its touring venues, festivals, divisions, it also added artist management. And in doing so, Live Nation Entertainment is also one of the things that people don't often talk about as much, by far the biggest artist management company in the world as well. a lot of Live Nation's artist management companies to this day operate under their own names. There was that moment a few years ago where they started working with Maverick. So the guy who managed Madonna and who had set up the label at Warner, which they then screwed over by signing that deal with them. But he ended up as part of the Live Nation family, and they did rebrand some of their management companies under the Maverick name. The idea being there would be a global brand for management around the world. But I mean, it didn't really happen. And lots of those management companies still have their own brands. And actually, you wouldn't necessarily even know they're owned by Live Nation if you go and look at their websites. But they are. So as a result of the Live Nation Ticketmaster merger, you ended up with this powerhouse that had all of those divisions. So to recap once again, touring, so biggest touring company in the world. Festivals continues to buy up several festivals a year in the UK, expanding that also in the US and elsewhere in Europe. Not as big in venues as AEG, but nevertheless a significant owner and operator of venues, plus ticketing, plus management.
So you could almost say they were a 360 live music company.
A full stack.
Yeah.
Live music company. I suppose they don't have booking agencies really, and no. I think to do so would be a conflict of interest.
Yeah.
I mean, you could almost say being managed by Live Nation is already a conflict of interest, although I'm sure every manager who's somehow in Live Nation will be very keen to stress that their clients are not obliged to tour with Live Nation or to sell their tickets through Live Nation or to play Live Nation festivals. And again, because of big companies, different divisions don't tend to talk to each other. That's probably true. But I think whereas maybe you can get away with being managed by Live Nation and also touring with Live Nation, I think it probably would be wrong if the agent was also within the Live Nation family. So generally, they haven't moved into the booking agency side. So that is one gap on the live side. But other than that, yes, they are operating across the live music space and through management and merch beyond live as well, I guess. And as you said, although the big conversation around competition violations were around the Ticketmaster merger in 2010, the so-called consent decrees from which, another use of the term consent decree in the music industry, have continued to be in the news sometimes in the US. There was also that Songkick case, wasn't there? Songkick sued Live Nation in the US courts, accusing them of anti-competitive behavior. And sometimes when they do an acquisition, I mean, here in the UK, on the festival side, I mean, they bought up quite a lot of festivals without it ever going to Competition Commission. But the Isle of Wight Festival was the one where it did go to the regulator.
Yeah, there were some concerns raised about that deal, and it did go to the UK Competition and Markets Authority, which did a consultation and spoke to lots of people from across the live music industry and ultimately decided it was fine. So that deal went through. But yeah, like you say, that was the big one. But like you say, yeah, they've bought lots of independent festivals in recent years, as have AEG and Global, the radio company that launched the festivals division. Bought up lots of festivals.
Now kind of bailing on that.
Yeah, it's now shutting down. But AEG, they're still going. They're still buying stuff up. But a lot of it, I think the UK festival sector went through a little bit of a wobble, particularly on the independent side. And the bigger players have taken advantage of that. I mean, particularly, I think getting the Isle of Wight Festival is, I mean, that's been independent for a long time and it's a big festival. And for that to become owned by Live Nation, is I think a lot of people, I mean, a lot of concerns were raised about that because a lot of people saw that as a big loss.
And talking about Isle of Wight, I mean, Bestival also, obviously no longer on Isle of Wight, but when Bestival went through its financial problems last year, the outcome of that was that Camp Bestival formed a JV with Live Nation. And yeah, you're right. I mean, those are some festivals who were proudly independent for a while. And I think in the UK, the independent festivals are probably the most vocal about competition concerns around Live Nation in this country. Maybe I just talk to independent festivals more than I talk to small venues, etc. Although lots of small venues, etc. and smaller promoters are also using Ticketmaster to sell their tickets.
Yeah.
But yeah, there are some smaller independent festival promoters who do feel that Live Nation is too powerful in the festival space and therefore has power over booking talent. Because if you have a portfolio of festivals and you're sitting down with the agents, then maybe you can get the bigger acts to play because you can offer them a number of different opportunities rather than just one. Although plenty of independent festivals do ultimately sell to Live Nation, even after on the quiet, sometimes bad-mouthing Live Nation for a number of years, because I think the economics of festivals are really tricky. It's hard making money out of festivals. They're not hugely profitable. You know, there is a reason why we usually build venues and just have a few bands playing in each town and city in those pre-built venues each night, each week, because the idea of building a temporary venue to host hundreds of bands over 3 or 4 days in a field is actually a stupid way of doing business. Creatively, culturally, magnificent, but actually commercially a bit stupid. So the economics of festivals, it is hard to make money at festivals, and you only need one bad year for whatever reason, and it can just be the weather, to pretty much drive you out of business. So you do see lots of festivals. I mean, we mentioned the other SFX earlier, and lots of dance music festivals sold up to SFX. Similar reasons. I mean, that was almost partly because as EDM boomed, the agents kind of got a bit greedy, and so the superstar DJs, the fees were going up every year. And lots of the independent dance music festivals just couldn't afford to compete. They didn't have the cash flow. Even if they could afford the cash, they didn't have the cash flow to pay those fees up front. And so they sold off to SFX V2. Whereas with sort of the other kind of festivals, a lot of them have ultimately sold out to Live Nation for that reason. And so that brings us to now, where you do have this powerhouse. And despite us sort of dwelling on some of the criticism of that growth, as we say, it is one of the definite success stories of the last two decades. I suppose on the live side, sometimes it's harder to measure success, or at least to compare that success with, say, the record industry. Obviously, in the 2000s, when recorded music was going down, 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 and live music was booming, a lot of people were comparing the two businesses. Generally, the live industry is less generous with stats than the record industry. And also, of course, recorded music is generally more profitable. So sometimes on the Live Nation side, if obviously Live Nation, public listed company, they do publish quarterly financial reports. And sometimes the turnover is massive because they're working with artists like Madonna, who charge phenomenal sums of money for their, you know, big stadium tours. And so they're bringing in a lot of cash, huge amounts of turnover. But artists like Madonna, her tours are expensive to run.
Yeah.
Because very high production values. And so actually, you never really get to know how profitable those tours are. So I think on the live side, massive turnover, well, but not necessarily that profitable.
That we talked, I think, last year about how Ed Sheeran had been the most profitable touring artist of the year, but that's partly because there aren't really any production values. It's him on a stage, and he's got the pedals, I think, quite expensive, but not that, you know, it's not going to break the bank on his tour. So he's drawing in a lot because he's not spending the money on other musicians and dancers and stage sets that someone like Madonna would be.
Yeah, and although he does have a sizable crew backstage, it is a relatively cheap show to run. I mean, to be fair to him, he passes those savings on, doesn't he? Because his ticket prices, given the size of act he is and the venues he's playing, are chunk cheaper than the equivalent artists who are touring elsewhere. But, you know, live can be a very expensive business. So even if the turnover is very impressive, it doesn't necessarily always mean there's huge amounts of profit. But nevertheless, Live Nation, for now at least, seems to go from strength to strength.
To strength.
With its touring over here, and its venues over here, and its ticketing over here, and its management over here, and its whatever else I've forgotten over here. And so it will be interesting to see where it goes next. Does it diversify into any other strands? There was at one point talk of a Live Nation Universal Music joint venture.
Mm.
And they were going to work, I think, on sort of brand partnerships and direct to fan. And then that went away. And that may well have been, oh my God, the thought of Live Nation and Universal Music coming together. If we're talking about competition concerns in the music industry, that would be the ultimate competition concern. But it will be interesting to see whether or not Live Nation does further diversify. It continues to grow all of those divisions we've already mentioned, but will it move ever more into other aspects of the music industry? Of course, as a live entertainment company, it also operates outside of music. It's also very active in comedy and theatre and other things as well. But whether or not it will ever go back like it dabbled with for a couple of years in the mid-2000s into other aspects of the music industry, I suspect not. I don't think they particularly enjoyed that experiment, but it will be interesting to see, I guess.
Yes, so there's your conclusion. The world's biggest live music company is big, continues to be big, and might get bigger. It's not as interesting as it all collapsed spectacularly. I think we will return to SFX at some point so we can discuss a spectacular collapse. But that's not one of our 20th anniversary episodes, and that is giving away secrets about the continuation of bonus episodes of this podcast that I'm not at liberty to discuss at this stage.
Of course, we could always talk about iHeart, the other Clear Channel business, which also has been, I mean, hopefully we'll come out of it the other side now, but for the last couple of years has been going through bankruptcy as well.
Yes.
So pretty much all the businesses we mentioned today that are in some way linked with Live Nation have had a very difficult 20 years. It just happens that we've honed in on Live Nation, the one business that hasn't.
Yes, and that brings us to the end of this special CMU 20th anniversary edition of Setlist. We're coming right towards the end of them now. You can go back and listen to all the others if you go to setlistpodcast.com. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It's edited by Jason Wolfe. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at unique facilities, Setlist is an unlimited production.